Welcome to Dear Prudence. I'm your Prudence, Janae Desmond-Harris. Today, we'll be talking about how to handle a person who tastes food in an unsanitary fashion and deeply annoys you while you're trying to cook in a tiny kitchen, what to do when your dinner party invitations are never reciprocated, and whether two people with extremely different eating habits can have a happy life together. Here to help me out is Dan Pashman. He's the founder and host of the 2-time James Beard Award-winning podcast, The Sporkful, where he obsesses about food to learn more about people. He's also the author of the new cookbook, Anything's Possible. Welcome, Dan.
Hey, Janae, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get started, I want to ask you something we ask all of our guests, which is for one piece of unsolicited advice. It doesn't have to be about food, but it can, or it can just be about anything.
Oh, geez. Well, you've caught me in a reflective mood because we've been doing this whole series on the Sporkful podcast about the making of my cookbook. And I think a lot of people, even who buy a lot of cookbooks, don't actually know how they're made. So I thought, let's tell a story about how they're made. People think it's interesting. It ended up sort of being like a reflection on like living a creative life. So I've been sort of pondering that a lot lately. And I guess my unsolicited advice, and I was just thinking about this morning, is that I think that most people, like you're greatest strength and your greatest weakness are actually tied up in the same personality trait. So a lot of like finding your way in life is about just sort of identifying what that personality trait is and then learning how to harness it for good.
Do you feel comfortable saying what your greatest strength / greatest weakness personality trait is?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, maybe greatest is the wrong word. I'm kind of like a high-strung person, you know. I'm not ever going to be lying on a blanket on a beach all day. My wife can lie on a blanket on a beach and read all day. I can do that for about 45 minutes. And then I'm like, I'm going for a walk. I'm going to go swim. I'm going to go do something. You know, like, so sometimes that's annoying. People don't always want to be with somebody who's like constantly, you know, let's go, let's go, let's go. On the other hand, like, you need to have a certain level of intensity to accomplish big things. And so, like, when I try to sort of set that personality trait, and I throw that into like, let's make a cookbook and spend 3 years trying to pull off this, what turned out to be like a Herculean task, then I'm like, oh, that's the trait being used for good instead of just sort of like being the annoying guy that won't chill out.
That makes so much sense. Then you don't have to sit there and think, oh God, I'm so annoying, I can't sit still. You can think, I'm someone who's, you know, able to stay up until 3 o'clock in the morning writing my cookbook, and that's a good thing. So it makes you love yourself more.
There you go.
I love it. Dan and I will dive into your questions after a short break. Can't get enough Dear Prudence? Then you should definitely join Slate Plus, Slate's membership program. You'll get to hear me answer an extra question every week just for members. With your subscription, you get ad-free listening across the Slate network and unlimited reading on the Slate site, including all Dear Prudence columns, past and present. Go to slate.com/prudyplus to sign up. It's just $15 for your first 3 months. Again, that's slate.com/prudyplus. Welcome back. You're listening to Dear Prudence, and I'm here with Dan Pashman. Let's get started with our first letter. It's titled Kitchen Chaos.
My girlfriend recently moved into my apartment, and it's been a difficult adjustment. I do the majority of the food prep and cooking, but I'm a large guy in a tiny kitchen. My girlfriend pops in to help, but the reality is, she's in my way and interfering. She'll toss in random spices or get in the way when I have hot pans going, and she has a gross habit of licking her finger and sticking it in the communal food to taste test it. I've already expressed that this habit grosses me out and it's unsanitary. All she has to do is get a clean spoon. Last time, I was cooking a whole chicken and she came up behind me trying to pull off a wing, singing some stupid made-up song, and I ended up banging the oven door on my knee and burning myself. I ended up cursing and yelling at her to get the hell out of the kitchen, and she got upset and locked herself in the bedroom the entire night. I apologized for raising my voice, but her behavior actually injured me. She told me I need to lighten up. I told her that this behavior wasn't cute, it's childish. The kitchen is small and cramped. I don't want to get cut or burn again. If she wants to take over cooking, I would let her, but she hates cooking and grocery shopping. She left it alone for about a week before starting up again. I turned off the stove, went to the bedroom to order pizza. She accused me of being petty. I love her, and I know this is a stupid hill to die on, but she just needs to stay out of the kitchen. We can chat with her sitting at the table. I don't know why a simple request is too much here. Can you help me?
pulling a wing off the chicken is outrageous. It's not like taking one piece of pasta out of the pot. You're having to use some muscle to get that off. Oil is going to splatter everywhere.
But is she pulling the whole wing or is it just the wing tip? Because I will pull a wing tip off of a roasted chicken. When the little tip of the end of the wing gets burnt, it's like charred. Mm-hmm. And and you can kind of like crunch right through the bone because it's so like sort of charred and crunchy crispy. That's a great bite right there. Okay. And I will. That wing tip doesn't usually make it to the dinner table when I'm cooking.
Okay, but what is your rule about this? So I'm guessing you spend a lot of time in the kitchen. Can you stand having other people in there? What are the rules and guidelines for being in the kitchen while you're really trying to do something?
Yeah, there's a meme, Janae, you might have seen it. They pop it up in your feed. It's always popping up in my feed once in a while, but it says something like, cooking together is not romantic. Get the fuck out of my kitchen.
Yes, I saw that and it was one of those things on social media that really made me feel seen because I don't even think I'm doing anything special in the kitchen. I always say I don't really think I can cook. I can make food. You know, I can make food that I can eat to live. If my husband comes in, he won't take food or pull a wing off a chicken, but he has a tendency to start cleaning while I'm still in there. And I think he does it without thinking because he knows as soon as he sees my eyes that I'm like planning a murder when that happens. It just, I don't know why, it just completely sets me off. We have a small kitchen. I also am like self-conscious about the mess I make while I'm cooking because I'm the dirtier one and he's the cleaner one. And I'm just like, get out of my space. It just sets my blood pressure through the roof. I can't deal with it. So I get where the letter writer is coming from, especially because this girlfriend is being extremely annoying.
Yeah, look, for me, when I'm cooking, like that's sort of meditation to me. I want it quiet. I don't listen to music or podcasts while I'm cooking. It's meditation in the sense that like it's one of the rare times where I feel like I'm totally present. I'm totally focused on the task at hand. And when I have time and it's not too rushed, I really enjoy that process. Mm-hmm. So I don't want people in the kitchen bothering me. To me, the thing that's most upsetting here is that she will toss in random spices.
Oh, see, that went right over my head.
No, that, I underlined that. She will, you're going to come into the kitchen while I'm cooking and just sabotaging? Mm-hmm. She's almost sabotaging. I mean, there's something about this that feels sort of like antagonistic. Mm-hmm. Or like, why aren't you paying attention to me? Mm-hmm. I'm going to come in here and take over and make you pay attention to me.
Right.
By screwing up what you're doing here and getting in your way.
So I want to say one thing in her defense, even though thinking about her actions just, you know, makes my skin crawl. Tell me if you agree with this. I think there is a lie perpetuated by the media in our culture that in a happy relationship, you're in the kitchen together, like hugging each other from behind and feeding each other a little bit of soup and like giggling and teasing each other. Don't you always see that in montages of happy relationships and movies?
Tasting things that the other one made.
Yeah. It's not true, but maybe she's bought into that and she thinks this is part of, oh, we moved in together and it's a happy time and I'm really being playful and bonding in the kitchen.
I guess, but once he's said, I really don't like when you do this, you would think that she would change course. But you know, you're right. There's a lot of romanticism around the kitchen and like it depends partly on the cook or cooks and their personalities and the relationships between them. And I'm always interviewing people on the Sporkful who talk about, I was in the kitchen with my mom growing up and helping her. Like, you know, I remember everyone gathering in the kitchen and family gatherings and parties, and these were special memories. So, like, yes, there are special moments that are created in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. But just, like, day to day, and especially, like, when you're focused on a task, on the task of cooking, like, it's not for everyone. Like you say, some people just want to cook alone.
Right. I mean, she caused him to get burned, and she didn't care. So again, this is past, I think it's fun to hang out and chit chat while you make dinner and you disagree.
Yeah.
The difference when it comes to should we hang and have fun in the kitchen together is not that big a deal. I don't think that's a huge incompatibility. That's something you can resolve. But the way they've handled it, I'm reading about cursing, yelling, going in the bedroom, locking the door for the whole night. It's all a lot. And it's almost to the level that it makes me think this is one of those times that moving in together before marriage is a good thing. Because it lets you test out whether you're going to be able to compromise with each other and treat each other decently around the kitchen and everything else.
Right. I agree. He also seems to be a little bit like, he could have a little more patience. You know, he's like, I'm sorry that he got injured, but also like, I mean, sometimes like cooking, you're going to bang things. You're going to get cut. Like even if nobody's in the kitchen, you're going to get injured. He's like, you know, it just seems like both of them are kind of like gravitating towards drama.
And sort of like they're insisting on their way of doing things.
Right.
And kind of immature.
They're both kind of like looking for a reason to escalate the situation.
Right.
rather than looking for a way to diffuse it.
Right. I think in a healthy relationship with two mature people, this could have gone very differently. Like he could have said, could you not? I got burned. How about this? I'll pour you a glass of wine. You can sit at the stool on the counter. Here's like some cheese and a couple of pickles and we can just chat. But could you not physically reach over me while I'm cooking? I would prefer not to get burnt again. And we wouldn't need the cursing, yelling, door slamming, silent treatment. And all the other ways this escalated.
You're right. And I still can't get over she will toss in random spices.
You're stuck on the spices.
I'm not going to let that one go, Janae.
I mean, yeah, that's you as someone who cares a lot about food. I'm just I pretty much put garlic, salt in
everything. That's a deal breaker right there.
Especially if they're the wrong spices, right?
Yeah. Right. Or even if it's too much of the right spice. Like, you know, you don't just, I mean, you just don't do that to somebody who's cooking.
Yeah.
You just go in and random, just like, I mean, it's like almost like she's sabotaging the food he's cooking.
He's so mad about this. You're right. It just meant, it's funny. Letter writer, I think I have a couple of ideas. You know, Dan, I'm always on this podcast telling people to break up, and I try to stay away from that, especially over something, you know, as simple as a little tiff in the kitchen. Could you plan some meals, like low stakes meals? I don't know, maybe low heat meals. Maybe you can make a salad, something you can do together that would be fun, where it wouldn't matter. Is there anything you can cook where it doesn't matter if someone throws too much spice in? I don't know. Could you like make a smoothie together in the morning? Could you make a snack plate together before you watch a movie? I feel like there are ways that you can be in the kitchen and both people can participate, and it's not going to lead to a catastrophe.
I'm not convinced that she wants to cook with him, Janae.
Oh, interesting.
He says she hates cooking and grocery shopping.
She just wants to be in his face.
Right. She just wants his attention and doesn't like that he's focused on something else.
Okay, here's another idea. I've mentioned before on the podcast some parenting advice that I learned at Instagram University in the comments, which says when you have a child and you're maybe not spending as much time with them as you might like because life is busy, if you could really take like the 10 minutes first thing in the morning to really connect, give them your full attention, really engage with them, and then do the same maybe when they get home from school or before they go to bed, those dedicated moments can really do a lot to kind of satisfy their need for closeness. Maybe he could treat his girlfriend like a five-year-old. And before he starts making dinner, they could just sit and cuddle on the couch. He could gaze into her eyes and ask about her day and then be like, here is your glass of wine and your Netflix show. Dinner will be on the table in 45 minutes.
Right. I like that. I think that's very good advice.
And maybe also talk about all this when there's not hot food around and spices out. Have a conversation.
Knives.
I'm sure there are times when you two get along, when you're going for a hike or you're lying in bed. Try to address it then. Yeah, when there's no spices, knives, or stuff that's going to burn you. You're listening to The Dear Prudence Show, and when we come back, we'll be reading more of your letters. Stay with us. Welcome back to Dear Prudence. I'm here with my guest, Dan Pashman, and the next letter we're answering is titled, Boring Meal Ticket.
My husband and I are both elderly, 79 and 80 years old. We have a lot of friends, most of whom are younger than our children, and we really enjoy their company. Our children and grandchildren live in other countries, so we don't see them very often, which makes us very happy to have young people around. The problem is that we do all the entertaining, mostly at restaurants, but sometimes in our home. We are fortunate to live in a place that has an abundance of excellent restaurants, so we go out several times a week, and we always pick up the tab for everyone. We usually have between 5 and 12 guests. From a financial standpoint, this is not a real problem, even though these meals are often over $1,000. In the last 3 years, since we resumed going out after COVID, we have been invited to someone's home only 2 times. Both times, it was drinks and a casual supper, which was lovely, and we really enjoyed it. One other time, we were invited to a charity event to which we made a large donation, and the company for which one of our friends worked paid for our tickets. We aren't expecting elaborate entertainment. Even being invited for coffee or a game of cards would be nice. However, I am beginning to wonder if these people actually like us, or are we just financing their weekly get-togethers? I was taught that when someone entertains you, it is then appropriate for you to reciprocate in some manner. Have times changed so that this is no longer the norm? I must reiterate that we are both very sociable and enjoy these meals, but we're both beginning to wonder if we're just buying companionship. We've taken some of these people out over 100 times, and they have never even bought us a cup of coffee. Wouldn't someone invite us to do something with them if they actually liked us and enjoyed our company?
Okay, so on the question of whether it's still a norm to reciprocate when someone entertains you, I think it still is. Do you? If someone has you over for dinner, you're supposed to have them over. It's pretty much still the rule. Everything went out the window with the pandemic, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's kind of a norm, but I think that, look, in general, in life, I don't think it's a good idea to put too much energy into keeping score.
Mm.
There are always going to be some people who are just very social. There are host types. There are people who like to have people over, who like to bring take people out to dinner. And there's some people who that's just not their mm-hmm. thing as much. There's certain people, you know, couples we're friends with where we invite them over more than they invite us, and vice versa. We have friends who, like, they have a pool in their backyard, and they are every weekend they're grilling and drinking, and it's like an open invitation every weekend, and we don't invite them as much as they invite us.
Right.
That being said, I wouldn't say that there's a rule, like a one-to-one rule for every invitation you must reciprocate. But I think that, like, while you shouldn't keep score and get hung up on exact equality, if someone invites you out 100 times
mm-hmm.
and you don't ever invite them, that's obnoxious.
Right. It is obnoxious, but I'm going to take the side of these young dinner guests because I've imagined a narrative where what they're doing kind of makes sense.
Okay.
I think it has to do with the age difference and the pretty obvious wealth difference. So I don't think the letter writer and her spouse are really positioning themselves as peers. And I think these dinners feel like they're falling outside of everyday social norms. So, for example, remember how Oprah used to host a gospel brunch?
Right.
If Oprah invited me to her gospel brunch, I wouldn't think, oh, you know what? I better invite Oprah over for taco night.
Right,
so
right.
These people are really rich. They're having $1,000 dinners all the time. I can kind of see how the people who are going are thinking of this less as being invited by a friend to dinner and more as attending a fancy event. And also maybe they just think they couldn't really reciprocate. Even though the letter writer says I'd be fine with a cup of coffee or whatever, I might be intimidated by having this really wealthy older person who hosts these lovely dinners all the time to my house to like just give them whatever food I was serving.
Those are all good points, Janae. Yes, I could understand that these younger people might be intimidated. They should still do something. They could all chip in and buy something nice, even if it's a one-time gesture. Even like a handwritten mm-hmm. thank you note, which costs nothing,
absolutely.
Is still just a gesture of appreciation. I think you raise an interesting point with this idea that like the two different sides of this group are kind of viewing the relationship differently.
Mm-hmm.
So the older couple thinks like these are our friends who just happen to be a lot younger than us.
Right.
Whether it's that the younger people think that they're being invited to a fancy occasion. I mean, if they're being invited over and over again, I don't know if that's it, but I think it's partly that like they could be thinking, well, these older folks, their kids and grandkids live far away. So we're kind of like doing a good deed.
Oh my God.
We like them.
Yeah.
I think the younger people do like them,
mm-hmm.
but they could also be thinking like, oh, like they're sort of our surrogate grandparents.
Right.
Parents or grandparents, and we're their surrogate kids or grandkids. And so like, sure, they're taking us out because like—
They love it.
Right. They love taking us out, and they're sort of the quote-unquote grandparents
yeah.
or the quote-unquote parents. So, you know, more often, you know, the parents or grandparents, especially when there's a financial disparity, I think might be the ones who would pay.
Mm-hmm.
So the younger people may not be thinking of themselves as sort of like peers.
That's such a good point. I think that's exactly what they're thinking. Oh, you know, we love to hang out with these people, and they love our company, and it's so good that, you know, we can give them a little entertainment and give them something to do, and it's great that they pay for dinner. I don't think the young people are in it for the salmon and the wine.
That's right.
I think they're enjoying it, but part of their enjoyment is not that they're looking at you, letter writer, as charity, but they think you're benefiting from their presence, like Dan said, as an older person who wants to be around younger people.
Right. And also the younger people think that the letter writer is getting sort of like, it's mutually beneficial. And that it's more of like a parent and child relationship or a
yeah.
grandparent to grandchild relationship where there's not necessarily an expectation that things will always be reciprocated. Like things tend to kind of, you know, move. Like I do a lot more for my kids than they do for me.
Right. That's something you don't want to score, Keith.
Right. Maybe when I'm 80, that will change. Certainly mm-hmm. my parents are around 80 and like I do more for them now than I used to, you know, and it will probably continue to move in that direction. But for a long time, if we were going out, the expectation would be that they're the parents, so they pay. So I think that that could be part of what's going on.
I wonder, is there anything you think the letter writer and her husband could do to shift this dynamic to one that feels more like a relationship between friends? Because I guess that's ultimately what they want, is a relationship that feels more equal, where they know that they're cared about and not being used.
I think you and I agree, Janae, that we don't think these young people are using.
I don't think so.
If there was someone you didn't really like, but they were going to take you out to some super fancy dinner, maybe you'd go once or twice for the meal or the experience. I'm not going to go hang out with people I don't like. I don't care how fancy the dinner is over and over again. So I think that the letter writer just needs to be reassured that these people do really like you.
Yeah.
And they do really want to spend time with you. They just might not view the relationship the way you view it, but it doesn't mean they don't like you.
Right.
They do want to spend time with you, and they are happy to spend time with you. And if you can afford to take them out, I would sort of say, like, don't stress about it. Keep taking them out and enjoy their company if you enjoy it. You know, and don't have this nagging feeling in the back of your head that you're somehow being used, because I don't think that's the case.
Right.
That being said, these younger folks could at least send a thank you card or a nice bottle of wine or something once in a while.
I also think there's a way the letter writer could sort of deepen the relationships to make them feel less like host and guest or grandparent and grandchild and more equal and friendly by doing things like keeping in touch outside of the dinners. So are you just texting these people with the weekly invitation in the menu, or, you know, maybe you could check in on them and their families. Maybe you could say a little bit about how you're doing. And maybe you could suggest occasional hangouts that are not $1,000 dinners. So, you know, would you want to meet up and go for a walk?
They could even have a party and send around like a sign-up sheet. You know, everyone sign up for what you're going to bring.
Right.
That's sort of a very direct way of being like, we expect you to contribute something.
Yeah.
Tell me if this is a good idea, Janae. What if this older couple were to ask one of the younger people to do something for you, like a small favor? Mm-hmm. Like, can you walk my dog? We're going away for the weekend. Can you take out my trash? Or I need a ride to pick up my car from the mechanic.
Yeah.
Some kind of like a small kindness, like a neighborly thing that friends do for each other to help each other out. It allows them to reciprocate and do something nice for you that doesn't cost money. It just requires a bit of effort. And if they're always saying no to that, then that sort of seems kind of rude.
Right.
But like it also kind of can level the playing field a little bit and puts them in a position where they're doing nice things for you also. And then maybe you wouldn't feel bad about that next $1,000 dinner.
I love that idea. It creates an opportunity for them to do something other than figuring out what to feed people for a dinner party and inviting you over and worrying about impressing you. It gives them a chance to do that. And it fits the theme of the grandparent-grandchild relationship. So if they really are in it to, you know, give you some company and enhance your life, then they'll also be willing to do these other little things. And letter writer, my prediction is they will. This is Dear Prudence. We need to take a break, but when we come back, more letters from you and advice from us. Stay tuned. I'm Janae, and you're listening to Dear Prudence. Dan, are you ready for our last letter of the day?
Let's do it.
Okay. This letter is titled, Food Isn't Just Food.
My girlfriend and I, both women, have drastically different eating habits, deeply stemming from childhood. We're not combining households yet, but we do spend significant time at each other's places, and each of us complains that there's nothing to eat at the other's home. How do we balance this and make each other feel welcome? She grew up in a household where money was tight, there was a strong Puritan sense that food was fuel, not enjoyment, and there were plenty of health issues but no metabolic ones. As an adult, she loves the previously forbidden enjoyment of chips, candy, etc., and is never without ice cream and beer in the fridge. She shies away from fruits, lean meats, and vegetables because they weren't part of her childhood, although she can now well afford them. She works out occasionally and has what doctors consider an ideal BMI. I grew up middle class with parents who loved to cook, and a family line of heart disease and blood pressure problems stretching back endlessly on both sides. My parents were big on fruits, vegetables, lean meats, and a big slice of homemade cake. I eat pretty similarly, and I keep purchasing sweets / salty treats out of my house because I'm liable to eat them and never stop. I do daily strength workouts and run mid-length races. I'm overweight and sensitive about it. When I'm at her house, the food makes me feel anxious about my weight, health, and my self-control. But when she's at mine, she feels hungry and deprived. How do we resolve this?
I've never thought about food compatibility as something that could make or break a relationship.
Oh, it's big.
Really? I mean, I think I've heard people saying like they wouldn't date a vegan or something because that would be a downer to them.
One that I get, people email the Sporkful a lot, they're having issues when it's like an adventurous eater, passionate about food, dating a picky eater.
Mm-hmm. I can see that. Now, I know that I just probably order way too much because I'm just sitting here thinking, okay, well, letter writer, you order some salmon and veggies, and your girlfriend can order fries and a Coke and a pack of gummy worms, and you can both eat your own thing, you'll be fine. But right. I realize everyone doesn't do that all the time. I would say the big slice of cake sounds like a place where there could be some agreement. So at least you could eat the same dessert. But overall, it strikes me that there's got to be a little more taking responsibility for yourselves and your preferences in this relationship. So getting anxious, just knowing that junk food is present in the house, sounds really, really hard. It also sounds pretty extreme to me. And for the letter writer, I do think that's something you want to try to tackle for yourself rather than trying to control your environment. I don't think you want to live knowing that you can't date someone who has chips in the cabinet. Is that fair?
Yes. I mean, I think it's extreme to be like, I can't ever have unhealthy foods in my presence. You know, like that being said, like there is actually interesting research, which like when you can see tempting foods, you're a lot more likely to eat them. For instance, like Google did a study, you know, Google's famous for having all kinds of free food perks in their offices. But then they realized that all their employees were eating a bunch of junk food and they wanted to encourage the employees to eat healthier food, but they didn't want to take away the junk food. So what they did is they put the healthy snacks in clear containers and the junk food in opaque containers. And they found that people were less likely to take the junk food if they couldn't see it without opening up the lid and like investigating inside. We have like our pantry in the garage of like food, unopened food. So if there's tortilla chips in the garage, unless I really am thinking about tortilla chips, it doesn't occur to me to go there and get them.
Right.
If my wife starts eating the tortilla chips and leaves them on the counter, I'm going to eat some tortilla chips.
Or even if you two are sitting there watching a movie and she's eating the chips next to you, even
That's
if it's
right.
just her little bowl of 10 chips.
100%.
You're still going to want them.
I'm a little more frustrated with a person who can't go to the other person's house without having junk food.
Really?
I mean, like, you need to have junk food all the time. Like, you can't go a day without chips. You know, like, just keep it in your car then.
Just run out to, like, people run out for a cigarette.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, just go sit on the back porch and eat your potato chips.
The girlfriend has to be eating some real food, right? Don't you feel there are ways, and you have kids, so I'm sure you've done this, there are ways to make sort of an unhealthy, snacky meal and then make it, like, healthier, more balanced for the parents. So could you make your girlfriend a box of macaroni and cheese? And then for yourself, you add broccoli and some protein and a salad on the side. I just see so many ways to compromise here. It can't be that, letter writer, you're only going to eat grilled chicken and vegetables with no chips in sight. And your girlfriend is only going to eat Sour Patch Kids and never like consume actual food. There's got to be places to compromise here. I think if you both could relax a little about your fear of overeating or being deprived.
I think that's good advice. My wife is not nearly as interested in food as I am. She doesn't care about food that much. You know, she likes a good meal. Her name's Janie, but she doesn't love cooking. She doesn't care that much about eating. When I go and travel for work, she will have cereal for dinner every night, like watching The Real Housewives, and be very content. It doesn't occur to her that she's missing anything. So sometimes we go out to nice dinners together and she'll enjoy it. Sometimes she'll be like, that was like, I don't get it. You know, I would have rather just had cereal. and so what I have become an advocate of, Janae, is what I call a polyeaterist relationship.
Oh, I like this. Okay, explain it.
So you should have other people that you go out to eat with, other friends. So like I have sort of my foodie friends or like coworkers. We love to eat and I come into the city for work and we go out to lunch at one of our favorite spots and we all enjoy it and that's really great. And then I go home and eat cereal with my wife. And so for the person in this relationship who wants to be able to eat more decadently, you know, that person has to be able to step out once in a while.
Okay. Yeah, I think this could really be a way things could work out. Actually, so I used to not have a sweet tooth at all whatsoever. Like changed after I had a kid, I guess hormones or what have you. But one thing I actually still don't like is pie. I just don't like pie. I don't like anything that feels gelatinous. I tend to hate the fillings. And my husband loves pie. And we used to have a joke that he was going to get a pie mistress, like just someone who would eat pie with him. So yeah, that would be a, what's it called? A poly...
Polyeterus.
A polyeterus relationship.
Yes, that's
so maybe
right.
There's some room for this here. Honestly, letter writer, I don't know what to tell you about what happens when you both come home from work on a Friday night and dinner has to be had and your girlfriend wants a Snickers bar and you want like some protein and vegetables. I don't know. I don't know what you do. Can you be in separate rooms? Should you both go out with friends and then meet up? I just go back to the idea that the real solution here is going to involve taking the sensitivity down a little and increasing the flexibility a little bit, whether that happens with therapy or practice or love motivating you to each stretch a little bit. I'm not sure. Okay, those are all the questions we have for this week. It's been fun and hopefully helpful. Thank you, Dan.
My pleasure. Thanks, Janae.
It was so great having you. Follow Dan on Instagram and Twitter at The Sporkful. And make sure to grab a copy of his new cookbook, Anything's Pastable, a collection of non-traditional pasta sauces. Do you need help getting along with partners, relatives, coworkers, and people in general? Write to me. Go to slate.com/prudy. That's slate.com/PRUDIE. The Dear Prudence column publishes every Thursday.
If you'd like to hear your question answered on the podcast, we're looking for letter writers who'd be comfortable recording their questions for the show. You can stay anonymous.
Dear Prudence is produced by Sierra Spragley-Ricks and me, Janae Desmond-Harris, with a special thanks to Maura Curry. Editorial help from Paola De Verona. Daisy Rosario is senior supervising producer, and Alicia Montgomery is Slate's VP of audio. I'm your Dear Prudence, Janae Desmond-Harris. Until next time.